Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted today to be able to speak to professional investor and ex-fund manager Graham Neary of Stockopedia and Vox Markets. So welcome, Graham.
Thank you very much for having me on your show, Paul. It's an honor to join the exchange.
No, likewise. I mean, I'll just get a bit of feedback, actually. My father's an avid viewer, and he's definitely saying he's enjoying all the shows. So I strongly recommend anybody who hasn't checked out Taking Stock at 12:30 each day. Graham goes through the big stock movers in the small cap, micro cap, and large cap sectors. Fascinating listen. So yeah, definitely it's worth anybody who's interested in serious investing, check that out. So well done, Graham.
Oh, thanks very much. Early days, but fingers crossed now it'll keep getting better.
Well, we've just gone through the sort of almost like the first 4 months. We've had sort of masses of geopolitical macro, and now we're in the US corporate earnings season, etc. But before we sort of like dig through the details and what your view for the markets, can you quickly remind, you know, investors of what type of stocks you look for, and is the Graham Neary hallmark?
Well, you and I went through lists of stocks. Was it just before Christmas or around Christmas?
Yeah.
A few months ago, anyway. And you commented that many of my favorite stocks had net cash, which it was true, but I like to think that I take a little bit of risk sometimes. I occasionally back unprofitable companies, so I'm not a stickler for has to be profitable every year or anything like that. It doesn't have to have net cash, but of course I do like those things. I love quality companies. I love companies where I understand the product, and I don't try to be an expert in absolutely everything. It's not possible. So I have a particular interest in financial companies where I feel it's possible for me to analyze them with a reasonable degree of understanding. Consumer companies, of course, like I know you cover consumer yourself, where you can understand the product quite easily, and occasionally things involved in software and websites. So those are sort of my bread and butter, and I like to think I've got a good eye for value and quality.
Well, I think you've been a bit modest there, because you definitely do a pretty good job of being an expert across most sectors, certainly when I've been listening to Taking Stock. But just in terms of this year's performance, how is the Graham Neary portfolio going? I did notice last night you had a bit of a sort of like a big tick up with Google and Alphabet, because they came out with some pretty stunning results with a dividend, I think.
Yes. So I do keep things separate between my personal portfolio and my sort of what I put out to the public in terms of my lists of my favorite stocks. For practical reasons, my personal portfolio, I don't inject money into it on a regular basis, and it tends to get overly concentrated in a couple of stocks, and I never sell anything out of it. So it's not really for public consumption, if you like. But obviously, I do disclose what's in it. I have Berkshire Hathaway, I have Alphabet, I have British American Tobacco, which we might talk about later. 888. So I do disclose what's in my personal portfolio, but in terms of what I put out in terms of my best ideas, I put a best ideas list on Stockopedia every year for the last 2 years. And so year to date, my top 10 stocks are up 19.9%.
Wow.
And that's really been driven by CMC to a large part, because only 10 stocks means that's quite a concentrated list.
That's CMC Markets.
CMC with the ticker CMCX. I own shares in IG Group, not CMC, but CMC is up 150% year to date, and that's been my big winner. Last year, I had a couple of big winners, which we talked about. Trustpilot is up 30% year to date as well. Also, that was a big winner last year. And had a takeover as well of Numis, the bank. So yeah, it's been a very good year for my Stockopedia list, and still 8 months to go. A lot can happen.
Well, you've been doing a lot better than me. My portfolio has been pretty weak over this last 3 to 4 months. In fact, I'm going to go on the sort of the investor couch here, Graham, and sort of like ask a general question. If anybody wants to ask questions, just jot them into the box and stuff. But I'm going to start off here in terms of identifying value plays and value traps. One thing I've suffered from for the last 12 to 18 months is that I've tried to be the steady Eddie, sort of safe, recycle some money into it. And I've got caught in companies that have attractive or low PEs, decent dividends, good, strong business models, franchises, but essentially the shares have gone nowhere. So for instance, I've had Pfizer, I've had General Bristol Myers, I've had a whole bunch of stuff that are huge companies, but frankly have gone nowhere. How do you sort of like disseminate or differentiate between a value trap and a value play?
That's a very difficult question, Paul. And
I
have been in the value trap so many times. And even today in my personal portfolio, you could argue I have value traps. So it's very difficult, but like just in terms of the last 2 years, what's worked for my best ideas lists in the first year was Trustpilot, which was not a value investment in the sort of traditional sense. It was an unprofitable company, which I could see making the transition into profitability. And I studied the business model, and I thought that the business model was amazing in terms of lack of competition. So that's where I sort of jettisoned value investing in a sense. Except you could argue that that I looked at its price to sales or price to recurring revenue multiple and thought that was cheap. So that was the sense in which it was a value play. Also the financial stocks, where I studied a lot of investment banks, a lot of fund manager stocks, and I did have some winners there, as Numis, as I mentioned. That is difficult because when you invest in these value stocks where it's net cash and it looks very, very cheap, you're really in some ways hoping for a takeover to realize the value, because you know the private investors and institutions who own it aren't going to get very excited about it in the short term unless trading really takes off. And again, who can predict that, especially for investment banks where they need a lot of IPOs and fundraising and activity, which nobody can really predict when that's going to come. So in the short term, value investing is extremely frustrating.
Tell me about it.
It's horrible in many ways. So you can sort of try to just diversify a lot and hope that on average it works out. You can be patient, you can hold for several years and trust that it will work. And sometimes you get lucky. So I got lucky, Numis got taken out. That really improved my performance last year, but that might not have happened. It could have easily just simply not happened. So it is a very difficult thing to do, but I suppose, you know, at the end of the day, we believe in logic. We believe that something is too cheap, that it should be at fair value someday in the future. So we have to believe it.
Yeah, now it's that classic Warren Buffett adage, isn't it? It's sort of like in the short term, the stock market is a voting machine, but in the long term, it's a weighing machine. I would say the way I sort of typically try and reconcile it, so I split into two camps of value, big cap, small cap, just generally speaking. Big cap being very, very liquid tends to be, and therefore you have a lot of price transparency and discovery and supposedly market efficiency. And the small cap liquidity is a lot less, so you can get bigger differences between price and value. But let's just talk at the top level in terms of big cap. And if you've got a liquid stock that the market is saying to you that it's cheap and they're worried, then it comes down to whether you as an investor have a different view to the market. And so it's identifying the rational, what the rationale, why is it cheaply valued, and then sort of deciding whether you're going to bet against it or bet with it. And that's sort of the big cap. Small cap, it tends to be a bit more idiosyncratic because you can get big swings. But I would say is if you're going to go into sort of like value plays and value traps, identifying it, you've just got to expect your hit rate's going to be low and you're going to get beaten up pretty bad. And if you do it in small caps, you can get some pretty big swings, because if you're wrong and it looks a cheap small cap, you're going to be wrong big time. I've done that many a time. Okay, well, let's move on to some of the fund managers, because I think you've just perhaps gone through, got to probably one of the cheapest financials I've ever seen, Jupiter Asset Management. And I'll just give some of the stats. It trades at about, well, actually, it's about 8 or 9 times PE, but it's about 6% dividend yield, and it keeps on going down. And it's one of the cheapest on a, I think it's on a market cap stroke asset undervalue and under management, isn't it? Sort of like ratio. But can you give us your latest on this one? Is this ever going to turn?
Yeah, I just felt like I should mention this one because this was one of the first fund managers that I turned positive on. I think it was late 2022 that I started to really perceive value. Now, so the share price is 76p today. I think I turned positive on it when the share price was something about 90p or maybe 100p in late 2022. And it's kind of the archetype of the struggling UK fund manager currently with consistent outflows.
Yeah, but there you go.
The outflows just never stop. They never stop.
Can you see that chart there, Graham? That's okay. It's coming up through, is it?
I can see the chart there. Thank you. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, it looks it looks unfortunately a bit of a falling knife.
Oh, yes. Now, what's the time frame on that chart, Paul?
That's 5 years.
5 years. Sorry. All right. Yeah. I can see that. Okay. Yes. So what I initially noticed was a lot of people use EV, enterprise value, to AUM in the space. I started doing something even simpler. I started doing AUM divided by market cap, just to give me a sense. And the way I described it to my audience was, I said, for every pound you invest in Jupiter or other fund manager, you get X pounds of AUM. And Jupiter had gone from some very low number, maybe it was £20 or £25 or something, to £100 plus of AUM for every pound you invested in it. And so I acknowledge, of course, there's a huge sequence of outflows, there is fee compression, there's the question about passive fund management, there's all these problems. But at the end of the day, I looked at Jupiter and I said, well, its assets under management aren't actually falling. And only in the last few days, they put out their Q1 update, which again showed assets under management not falling because of investment returns offsetting the outflows. So it's this strange incident. And I thought of a new way of thinking about it the other day, where fund managers are one of the few companies where customers can consistently leave them and yet the business keeps getting bigger. I mean, I don't know of any other business like that where they have fewer customers. Customers are quitting, but the business keeps getting bigger because the customers who don't leave have accounts which continue to grow. So I want to mention this because I still think it's value, possibly a value trap, okay, but it's cheap in terms of AUM, it's cheap in terms of earnings multiple, and even you could start to make a balance sheet argument where tangible net assets were around £280 million at the end of last year. So with a market cap of 440, actually the company's balance sheet is covering a large chunk of the market cap. And so a bit like other financial stocks I've looked at where the cheapness is extraordinary, a takeover would really solve the problem. If they would just get taken over, I'm sure if somebody would pay a lot more than 440 for this.
You're right. I mean, I've rationalized Jupiter, and the way I look at it is such that at the moment, unfortunately, Jupiter as a planet is a damaged brand. Okay, if they move it to Saturn, or they move it to sort of like I was going to say you're right, but another say Earth or planet Earth or something like that. They call it. They need to rebrand it. Or alternatively, get taken over and then rebranded, then you can basically lift and shift all that AUM into a company that essentially people aren't going to sort of say, well, this has had a bad track record for years and years and years. It's lost its fund manager and all this sort of stuff. It needs to change its name, basically. And I think that would make a huge difference.
Well, Neptune's already taken, isn't it?
Oh, is that okay? Oh, geez, isn't it? Yeah, Neptune's is, isn't it? Pluto.
Is Pluto still a planet? I'm not sure.
I don't know. It's a Disney character, I think.
Yeah. Well, there must be another one, I'm sure. There's nine planets. Yeah. They can find a good one.
Okay. Well, let's move to another one in the fund management sector. You've got AJ Bell, which is obviously the consumer investment platform. I use it. You probably use it. Everybody does, like with Hargreaves Lansdown. This is a slightly more expensive one, but it's still growing. And I think it really is a best in class. I mean, I've used this platform for 25 years and never had a problem, really.
Yeah, so I'm a fan of this one. Funnily enough, I'm also a shareholder in Hargreaves.
How'd you rationalize that?
Well, again, cheapness. So maybe it's another value trap. But I like both companies as investments. But obviously, AJ Bell is priced a lot better or a lot richer.
17 times PE.
Yeah. So AJ Bell is significantly more expensive. But I thought maybe it would be worth mentioning they had their Q2 trading update not too long ago, just a week or two ago. And I thought it was very positive, great flows. They've got an asset management business, which saw AUM growing 49%. So bucking the trend of in the fund management sector, and maybe I hadn't really considered how valuable that business could be in the fullness of time. And so, yeah, I just want to mention this one, a high quality, kind of the upstart in a sense compared to Hargreaves Lansdown. I would say, in terms of having a good brand, maybe that's the slight weakness. Maybe you could speak to this. You know, is Hargreaves still the better known, bigger, more valuable brand? Would you agree with that?
I use them both, actually. And as a customer, I'm happy with both. They're both head and shoulders above any other banks. I've used previously HSBC, Barclays. And in terms of quality, price, execution, they're the best. I would say out of the two on a consumer basis, AJ Bell to me gets slightly ahead than Hargreaves at Lansdown, but I can't complain. I mean, I've got half of my portfolio with Hargreaves Lansdown. As a brand, yeah, I would say the AJ Bell is the kid on the block coming up and doing well, but I've used him for ages. And Hargreaves Lansdown probably needs to invest a bit more into its technology and become a bit more sort of like sharper in terms of its execution. But yeah, I do think that's more than reflected in the valuation difference, with 17 times on AJ Bell and about 12 or 11 times for Hargreaves Lansdowne.
Yeah, so maybe both shares are priced quite intelligently in a sense. Yeah. But that Q2 update from AJ Bell, assets under administration were up 17% over the last year. I think that's a very impressive growth rate in a bad year.
Yeah.
So
that must have been your portfolio then, Graham.
No, that's not, that one's not in my portfolio.
Because you use Hargreaves, don't you?
Oh, right. Oh, very funny. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move to Premier Miton, which is the one I own, and it's another similar, but it's a fund manager classic, mainly open-ended funds, so it hasn't got the more stickier investment trust. But in the sort of like boutique side, small cap side, it's had a flood of AU, of assets under management going out like everybody else, fund redemptions, etc. But it just came out with an update in its trading, and essentially similar to the previous ones, we've had a fund performance out, but beating the small outflows, so have actually had an increase in AUM. And what was more sort of encouraging was the CEO was talking about the outlook, saying with interest rates coming, you know, hopefully falling later on, and with more optimism and sentiment coming into UK equities, he's actually pretty optimistic now for the rest of 2024. So I thought that was quite interesting, because the shares likewise trade at, well, effectively you get more than £100 of AUM per every £1 of share price you buy. I don't know what your thoughts on this one. It seems again very, very cheap, but it does seem to have turned here in terms of the share price. Let me just put the chart up, as in like it's just turning, I think, around about sort of like here. People are basing out and getting interested. It's a beta play basically on the stock market.
Yeah, I think, this one is a little different to the other fund managers in the sense that it is smaller. So it's about 10 billion AUM, about 100 million market cap. So it is a small fund manager, but I don't think it's subscale. I think there's no problem in terms of being subscale. So that's fine. In terms of being small, maybe you could argue that it has an advantage in that it can point to small caps and mid caps and say that's our niche. So to do a comparison with Jupiter, and compare with any fund manager, you want to, what I look for is a niche where they can say we're the experts in this, and if anybody wants to invest in this type of thing, we are the experts. And so maybe that's the advantage that Premier Miton has. But in terms of those net inflows, like, would you see those net inflows as being, well, how significant would you say they are? Would you say that they are going to turn the corner and see inflows soon? Or is it just what's your view on that?
Well, basically the industry, particularly in the small cap, has had 34 consecutive months of net outflows in terms of, redemptions and contributions, etc. The CEO, what's happened with Premier Miton is that's definitely slowed, if not almost gone to zero. The CEO is now seeing contributions coming into the actual funds, particularly, this new ISA season and the new sort of like, tax year, and with interest rates coming down. So he believes that he's going to start seeing inflows, plus with the better performance in the small cap sector, if we do get that, then you could rapidly see this AUM go from just south of £11 billion to, well, I mean, there's no reason why this can't get back up to 15 billion, which is what they were at, and maybe even 20. And then you effectively double the business over 3 to 5 years. And I think actually in reality, they won't be given a chance because somebody will buy them out at 100 million market cap. They're just a brilliant piece of, fund management real estate to have. And you're right in terms of scale. You've got Jupiter making EBIT margins of 18%, and actually Premier Miton make exactly the same, 18%. So they've got the scale benefits. It's all a matter of execution and performance. And their funds have actually been reasonably well performed, I think. They've done, over the long term.
Yeah, I mean, I would also be positive on this one, because not only would I say see AUM probably or hopefully or possibly recovering to 15, 20 billion, but then you improve the rating on that as well, and you get the double benefit. So, yeah, it's tricky. We have one or two other fund managers to look at as well, don't we?
Yeah, well,
Where,
let's go to Ashmore, which is basically the
yeah.
last one, which is basically the emerging markets one. It's unfortunately been pretty much decimated as people have taken money out of emerging markets over the last 3 years, particularly as the dollar has strengthened and yields on 10-year treasuries have increased, which has meant there's been effectively a yield play out of emerging markets into the state. And also the other thing is that what is emerging markets? Most of it's China, and China's just been a dog's breakfast, hasn't it, for 2, 3 years. So what's your sort of like, is this going to turn? This is the question. I mean, this really is a share that has been battered over really 10 years, I think. I'll put the chart up in a moment.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few points about Ashmore, and you've sort of touched on them, Paul, that are different to the other ones, different to the Jupiters and the Premier Mitons. So, if you're interested in the fund management space, but you don't want to get involved in the sort of conventional stuff, Ashmore is more about the dollar, interest rates, as you say. And the strong dollar has just been relentless. I don't know if you're familiar with Peter Schiff. I used to watch a lot of Peter Schiff's videos, and it's all about, these predictions of dollar collapse. They never happened. The dollar just got stronger and stronger over time, especially against emerging markets. And that is a headwind, but at the end of the day, Ashmore has a niche, fixed income emerging markets, and I think that is difficult to replicate in passives. You would think that an active manager in emerging market fixed income would be able to add value. Also, the CEO here, Mark Coombs, is the founder. He has 31% stake. So, that's really the basis of his personal wealth is his holding in this company. So that's another point which you don't get with a lot of other fund managers, a founder, shareholder, CEO like that. The outflows here have been relentless, but this is a really big company. This is $54 billion of AUM. So it's on a totally different scale to, the other things we've looked at.
It's still priced, though. If you look at it from market cap to AUM, it's on about, well, it's 1.2 billion. So just doing the math, it's about 1.7, 1.8% of AUM.
Yeah, so but this has a very, very strong balance sheet. So they have a seed portfolio worth nearly £300 million.
What's a seed portfolio?
So it's where they have to, so when they start a fund, they fund it themselves so that they don't have to look for external money to start new funds. They can start new funds with their own money
Okay.
and then get external money in afterwards. Kind of, you prove your track record and you get it up and running with your own funds first. So they have a lot of their own money invested. So, you could argue that you could just take 300 million off that market cap, straight away, on that basis. And then they obviously they have a lot of other balance sheet assets as well as that 300 million pound seed portfolio. So that's in my opinion, that's why the PE ratio here and the market cap to AUM ratios are a bit off. They look more expensive than they really are. Just bear in mind the dividend yield here is about 9%. It's been an incredible payer of dividends to shareholders. And okay, I think you could argue that the dividend is a little vulnerable because maybe they've been paying out slightly more dividend than EPS for the last couple of years. I acknowledge that, but still, I think a unique business. And run by a founder shareholder. So I think it's worth a look.
Good. Okay. Well, we've had one question coming in. It's from R. I'm not sure what his surname is. Any thoughts on Jenny Drive? I've never even heard of. Well, I think they're a molecular diagnostics firm. I don't know if you've ever covered them at all. They're only about 17 million market cap. They're what's the ticker? He says their ticker is GDR. I don't know if you've ever looked at it. I guess you probably haven't. It's too small, but
I think I've heard of the name. I might have thought it was Gene Drive.
Yeah, sorry, Gene Drive. That's it. Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, sorry, but I must have pronounced it incorrectly. That's how much I know about it. I know it was. I think it was basically a pandemic darling, wasn't it?
I mean, I just looked up their stock report, and looks like they had revenues of £55,000.
Okay.
Last year, so
pre-revenue. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think we'll park that one. In fact, that, I mean, obviously, that's looking at the. You need to look at the long-term cash flow and the, you know, basically the USPs of the actual technology. I personally can't comment because I haven't really given it a proper look. Okay. Well, let's move to the property sector. We've had some very interesting and encouraging statements from all the house builders. Starting also, we've got some of the brick people all saying that yes, it's tough at the moment. It has been in Q1, but the spring selling season for housing is actually happening. We've had more competition in the mortgage markets. Yes, we've had sort of like a lot of wet weather as well, which has impacted a bit of construction and build in the first 3 months in the UK. But the outlook's improving. So let's just turn to Winkworth, which is a small sort of like, I think it's a estate agent franchise in London, does sort of like well-to-do homes, sort of mid and upper tier, etc. Do you want to take us through this one? Because this is quite a new stock that a lot of people haven't really looked at. 22 million market cap, 7% yield on about a 12 times PE ratio.
Yeah, so this really springs from my interest in the Property Franchise Group and Belvoir, which merged. Mm. And now that they've merged, we've got one fewer of these property franchising groups to look at. So then attention sort of turns to Winkworth, which is sort of the smaller sibling of the set of them. But again, they had their results out in the last week or two. And it's a similar theme as we've seen before. 2023 was a tough year. But these companies have significant lettings operations. And when you have lettings operations, they tend to stabilize the entire performance.
I think it's 50-50, isn't it? It's about just over 50% lettings.
Yes. Yeah. So it's, I mean, I've made the comparison on taking stock with the recruiters having a lot of contract work versus permanent work. It's the same sort of thing. Lettings are stable. They're sort of impervious to the cycle. Sales are a lot more exciting. They're much more cyclical. And so, but Winkworth has, I think, many of the same attractions as TPFG and Belvoir in the sense of a clean balance sheet, cash generation, paying dividends, and also the quality metrics are extremely high. Now, I do think TPFG and Belvoir are probably higher. Maybe that's to be expected, given that they're, you know, bigger company and now they've merged, they're even bigger. So you get all these economies of scale. Winkworth, a bit smaller, but on the basis that it's the same business model that has been so successful elsewhere, Winkworth itself has been consistently profitable for as long as I know. I think that these are just really, really top class shares. And if you can get them at a decent earnings multiple, they just seem to do very nicely for investors. Winkworth currently at 11 times earnings, paying a 7% yield. I honestly don't see what's not to like here.
Yeah, how do you value a company like this? I was just trying to get the stock chart for the Property Franchise Group, but where is it? I might have to try some other website.
PPFG.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it didn't come up. TP, FG, the platform. For some reason, it didn't spot it up. Okay, I'll try somewhere else on it. But how do you actually value these shares? I mean, that's I mean, what's quite interesting. You've got Winkworth on an EBIT margin of roughly 22%. But as you rightly say, with a bigger scale, the property franchise group and the merger of
Belvoir.
Belvoir puts it up to 34%. So they're almost another 50% higher, i.e., 22% versus 34%. So how would you value sort of like Winkworth? Because I mean, if they can continue growing and take out some of their costs, then there's no reason you're going to get an acceleration, aren't you, of your margins as well as sort of your top line as the sales of properties got increase.
Yeah, I mean, long term, you would certainly expect the trajectory to go in the same direction as TPFG and Belvoir. So, I mean, honestly, it always struck me as a little funny that they would trade so cheaply. I mean, if I try to make a bear case or try to argue, if I try to argue for a modest or low earnings multiple, you would argue that it's the housing exposure and the cycle that people are nervous about. But then I think they've proven that even in bad years in the housing market, they still make money, they still generate cash and earn good returns. So it's a really strange one where I've been looking at especially the other two, but Winkworth to a lesser extent. I've looked at them for quite a while and I just struggle to find bare arguments. They must exist.
Yeah, I think they're both very good businesses. And as you say, with that cycle of the property sector coming back, then they should be a beneficiary, both the property franchise group and Winkworth. Okay, well, in terms of sort of like property or building products companies, one company that I know is coming out with results fairly soon is Lords Group Trading. And this one basically is a sort of 50-50, slightly bigger on the building merchants type of division, but it also does plumbing products and sort of like energy efficiency, sort of heat pumps and stuff like this. And it's done, but it's got a really sort of entrepreneurial culture within the actual business. They've obviously been hit, recently, a bit like Travis Perkins. But I do think this one's going to be, a cyclical winner, and it will rebound strongly over the next year. In fact, I remember interviewing not long ago Gervase Williams of Premier Miton, and he said this is going to be the turnaround story of 2024. And I actually think we've now reached a sort of a bottom in this building products sector, and certainly by the end of this year, we will start to see some serious construction. Certainly, when you look through the lens and say, okay, we're coming into a general election. If Labour win, as seems likely, it's going to be a massive building program on affordable homes and probably rented, really cheap rented accommodation, which is going to help, and also infrastructure. And this does both. It's going to provide this sort of like, literally the building blocks for all of that into the sector, and they've been consistently winning market share through the cycle. So if you're looking for a, I think if you're looking for a cyclical recovery stock with a sound balance sheet, good dividend, experienced management team that's been through 35 years of sort of ups and downs, then I think Lords Group's trading's as good as any. But I don't know if you ever had a look at this one at all.
I've not studied it in any detail, I must be honest. I did read Breedon's trading update the other day, which I think is in a similar idea, construction materials. And they said the wet weather was obviously a problem, but they also said ongoing macro uncertainty. Something I've been trying to tease out, it's very difficult to tease it out, but what is the is it mostly weather, or is it macro? Is it sort of a bit of both?
Well, what
What would
happens
you
is
say?
it just what happens. It's just lead and lag because
Mm.
you know, when it comes to breaking ground on a building and construction site, who are the first people who see it? It's usually the construction designers, the architects who start making moves. There's all of those, unfortunately, your WS Atkins have been built, you know, have been bought up. So you can't see it. So the next one is then the house builders anticipating starting breaking ground on new sites that they haven't yet put any sort of, like, you know, brickwork in, any foundations in. So they've already started. The next part of it is obviously once they've started, begun doing that, you then start seeing the rental, you know, effectively the equipment rental guys, your likes of HSS and your Speedy Hire and your VP, who then come in and provide some of the foundational work. You've got the brick boys. Ipstock said it was starting to see some benefits, improvements for the back end of this year. Then once you put the foundations and the cement, then you get all the building products. So this is just a lag and a lag, in my view. It's when it comes to it, it isn't an economic uncertainty. I actually think it's just a really sort of timing issue. And so the building products will be more towards the back end of this year. Early next year, we'll start seeing that extra volume coming through.
Very interesting. You laid it out perfectly there, the sequence of events. Yeah. Very interesting.
I would have thought so anyway. Okay, well, let's move to one tech stock you quite like is PayPoint, which is sort of like the one where you go into a retail outlet and you can sort of pay your BBC license fee and all kinds of different things. And I thought it also is a Christmas hamper business, relatively cheap. But I would always question the growth on this stock, but it does seem to be still growing top line well, making very good margins. I was just looking at it. PayPoint 39%, is that right? EBIT margins, crikey. And pays a 7% dividend as well. So highly profitable. So it's got a critical mass and the economies of scale. What's your latest on this one?
Yeah, well, I think we're going to talk about buybacks again a little towards the end of the show. But I was very excited by PayPoint's post-close trading update for the financial year to March. They said underlying EBITDA will be in excess of £80 million for FY24. So this company has I'm using Stockopedia here, market cap 380, enterprise value 270, and they're going to do underlying EBITDA in excess of £80 million. Now, of course, underlying EBITDA is not the same thing as net after tax net income, but still, that is screaming cheapness to me. And it's also a significant growth on last year. Just trying to remember what I think that this is underlying EBITDA growth of about 30%. I'll need to back check myself now. But there is significant growth there in underlying EBITDA.
But what's its top line? Where is it seeing growth? Is it basically adding on new services, that new ways of people to can pay through its payment sort of operations? And also we've got that e-commerce, you can drop off deliveries and pick up deliveries at local. Is it that type of e-commerce type players, people who are a bit reticent to pay with cash, then pay with on a digital, but, you know, haven't really got their own accounts?
Yeah, so that's the sort of the core business is the terminals in convenience stores, but their partnerships in terms of deliveries is also a growing area, but of course the other point is that they've got non-organic growth as well because they bought Appreciate, which is a company that I was a former shareholder of, which gave them the Love to Shop brand.
That's the Christmas hamper business, isn't it?
It's both the gift voucher business and it's a Christmas hamper business.
Right, okay.
And that gift voucher business, I think, could have a lot of potential because it's one of the most well-known gift voucher cards out there. So That's going to be a big contributor now. I thought I don't have the details to hand, but I remember thinking at the time that they had bought Appreciate at a very decent valuation. I mean, appreciate, some people think, not necessarily me, but some people think that appreciate wasn't very well managed in the years leading up to that event to being taken over. So PayPoint got a really good deal there. But then the kicker is that PayPoint said that on the basis of the strength of their performance, underpinned by sustained strong cash flow, and they've always had amazing cash flow, they say that they're, given their confidence in achieving their financial targets, they now have under active consideration a share buyback program to further enhance shareholder returns. And so, you know, the dividend yield here is already 8%.
Mm. Yeah, it's more than the PE ratio.
It is. And then throw in a buyback program, and they're buying back the shares at a PE ratio of about 7.5 times.
Yeah.
You know, there could be it could be a great value added for shareholders purely from the buyback, I think. So I think that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, you know, and it says great confidence, doesn't it? If it does a, you know, a buyback program, and it deserves to because the shares are ridiculously lowly valued, then it means that the management team have got confidence in the visibility of its top line and its cash flow going forward. So, I think I guess it comes down to that question, doesn't it, right at the start? Is this a value play or is this a value trap? And the market's pricing it to a value trap. But actually, if your thesis is that actually it's got still growth and it's got, you know, opportunities to expand its top line, then it isn't. It's a value play. And so you've got to bet. But I would say in the smaller cap sector, where liquidity is lower, you've got a better chance of making that, you know, that choice. Okay, good. Well, let's move again, a bit of a combination between the sort of the build tech sector and sort of software. We've got one of my second biggest stock is called Alico. And it came out with results this week. As I say, disclose, I own it. And I've owned this share for 8 years. Essentially what it does, it allows big contractors, the likes of Costain and, you know, Balfour Beatty and people like this, to manage huge infrastructure products or projects, or even, you know, sort of like renovations of big iconic buildings like Claridge's, as I found out earlier in the week, and stuff like that, to do their putting a new 5-story basement in. But it's complex buildings that allows you then to do sort of your 3D mapping, your project management, to bring it all in cost, but to also put in things like ESG in terms of, you know, carbon footprint, energy footprint, and then hand it over, create a digital twin, hand it over then to the asset managers, who then can run it as for the landlords as well, so they can manage it more efficiently with greater productivity. They have reached a tipping point. They've moved from being a perpetual license business to now 75% recurring revenue streams. Their margins are increasing, and they're making a bridgehead into the US, where they're seeing some decent traction. They recently bought a small business to give them more implementation capability out in Eastern Europe, which was strategically the most sensiblest deal I've ever seen, because not only helps them actually, you know, touch more customers and potential upselling, but also gives them sneakily a nice little foothold next to Ukraine when that country eventually has to rebuild its infrastructure. So it's got a local presence in that whole area. And I just think this one is a coiled spring. I mean, just to give you an indication, this comes down to valuation. If you look at it purely on a PE ratio, which I think Paul Scott, your colleague, does all the time and says it's expensive. Yes, it looks expensive on 21 times or 22 times, whatever it is. However, if you look at it on a PEG ratio over 3 years, it runs at less than 1 times, because the EPS is set to grow with margin accretion and top line growth at over 20%. So it's less than a PEG ratio of 1. Plus, this is the real beauty of it. Its gross margins are 90% plus, and therefore it's more attuned to value this on an EV sales basis, because that gives you an indication of what a strategic buyer would generate in terms of a potential M&A deal. So with 90% gross margins, this trades potentially about 2.2 times EV sales. Now, to give you an indication, the sector is well over 5 times. And in fact, Bentley Systems and Schneider Electric are looking to merge their software businesses on 13 times sales. So you haven't got to be Einstein to realize this is a nice sector, i.e. it's you know, digital twins, build tech, etc., is growing on a secular basis. It's got a cyclical upturn as well, hopefully coming. It's got the benefit from SaaS coming through with recurring revenue streams with higher margins. Plus, it's ridiculously lowly valued. So when it comes to value plays and value traps, I'm putting all my chips into this as a value play and my second biggest play. But people don't see it as a value because they look at it on a straight 21 times PE, which is madness in my view. But hey, don't know if you've ever had a look at this one.
I mean, I don't know much about their products specifically, but I do agree with the argument that for good quality software companies, you can give them leeway in terms of PE ratio. And that's a lesson that I only learned in the last couple of years. I started to trust the way that Americans did it a little bit, you know. If you look at US listed software companies, you expect EV to annualized recurring revenue of 5 to 7 times. Mm. And that's not even considered expensive. That would be considered normal or possibly cheap. In a big crazy bull market, these companies trade at 10 times plus annualized recurring revenue easily. Now, I tend to get very nervous at that point and say that they're overvalued. But in the case of a Leco or a Leco, we've got recurring revenues of over 20 million pounds. And I guess that can grow from, maybe they still have a little bit to convert to recurring revenues. But in any case, you would, with a market cap of 80, you could take the cash off that, I guess, 10, so get down to 70, and then divide by recurring revenue of about 20, and you get 3.5 times, which is below the bottom end of what I think
Their IRR after in March, the end of March, was 24.5 million, so nearly 25.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, then, look, it's clearly below, in my opinion, it's clearly below the bottom end of what Americans would pay.
Yeah. Well, anyway, let's wait and see. But I've held it for 8 years, so I'm not stopping anymore. Okay. Well, let's move to a different sector. We've got, I guess this is the archetypal value play or value trap. We've got BATS, British American Tobacco. And this was obviously I think it was a Neil Woodford darling 20 years ago. He loved this area. In fact, he loved this with Glaxo. I don't know why, but he did. Anyway, it's an iconic, obviously, cigarette manufacturer that's trying to move into smokeless products as well, which are obviously healthy. And what was quite interesting was the vision of the CEO is to essentially make all his products safe and move to a smokeless environment by in 10 years. What's your sort of the attraction to this one? Because obviously it's assuming you're okay on the, which you are, but if you're okay on the moral side of the tobacco, what's the sort of, like, as an investment case, the investment thesis?
Yeah, I mean, just on the ethics of it, I don't take the ethics of it lightly, everybody has to come to their own view on it. In terms of the attraction here, obviously it's trading at 6 times earnings, dividend yield 10% plus, and the bonds are investment grade. But what really just got me thinking about it again the other day was there's an American investor I follow on Twitter, Trevor Scott, and he went as far as to create a website called cancelthebatdividend.com. Now, I don't know Trevor, but I just thought, well done for having the initiative to create a website over this thing that's annoying you about BAT.
Yeah.
And I could not agree more with what he's saying. He is saying that if they simply redeployed the dividend into share repurchases, it would create an enormous reduction in the share count. And when you start doing the maths, and Trevor's done it, I mean, for me, it's sort of intuitive, but if the share price didn't rise, you would reduce the share count by 80% in 4 or 5 years. And so what that would mean is earnings per share would start to explode in an incredibly dramatic way. And obviously, well, I think it's fair to say that the share price would not stay at its current level with that sort of reduction in the share count. But the point is, why aren't they doing it? And why don't we have even more buybacks in the UK market? I mean, when I open the RNS every morning, I do see far more share buyback announcements than I ever saw before. And that's great news. But I would like to see even more when we have shares that are so, so cheap. What is the point of wasting all the cash on a double-digit dividend when you could reduce the share counts of these companies by half, within a fairly short period of time if they got serious about the buybacks? And so that's why I was so happy about PayPoint and then with its announcement. And there's other companies as well where they're now actively considering a buyback. And one final point I'd make about it is that it's even a potential defense against takeovers. You know, if we want companies to stay listed and not get bought out cheaply by overseas or private buyers, we want companies to stay on the stock market. One way they can stay is by buying back their own shares, which means that they're less of a target, A, because the share price will go up to a more to a higher level where it's more expensive to buy them. And secondly, they, I've lost my train of thought completely, but the point is that they will be safer from getting bought out if they do these buybacks, because at the low valuations they sit at, they're a sitting target. Now, you could say British American Tobacco is not a takeover target because it's simply too big. You know, there's very few companies who could buy it, but still, you know, it's obviously, you know, at a ridiculously cheap earnings multiple, and it could have one of the biggest buybacks in history if it wanted.
Yeah, I mean, I think they've obviously must have discussed this at the board level with the shareholders. There's two issues, I believe, but the reason why they're keeping the dividend is one, because most of the investors, their shareholder base, want a high dividend for whatever reason it is that, you know, they prefer a 10% dividend yield rather than the 5% dividend yield. And if they annoy their shareholders sufficiently, they will sell, and then you're going to struggle getting new shareholders, because it isn't everybody who wants to own a tobacco stock. So if you have to disgruntle your shareholders, that could just lead to a worse rating. And then on the economics of it, if there is any still lingering regulatory risk in terms of tobacco, I know they paid all the litigation out and they've settled it, but you still get people like Rishi Sunak banning tobacco in the UK for certain ages, as we've just seen that new legislation put in. Or if there's anything else in terms of regulation out there, then if their shareholders have probably said, actually, we don't want to have to wait to get all our money back when we sell it. We actually want money up front, and that's the reason why they've got a high net debt to EBITDA ratio of about 3.5 times, because they're basically just running this as a cash machine. It's an ATM, and they're just paying out as much money as they can do, quickly as they can do, to investors without damaging their investment grade, because they know there is always a very small but lingering niggle investors that there could be a regulatory issue or something out there that basically could hit them. And then they're not going to get a chance to get to sell out and, you know, get all their money back in one go, as it would be in a capital appreciation. So that's how I would view it anyway.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would be happy for the exact same amount of money that goes into dividends to go into buybacks. And
yeah.
But I take your point that it does reflect what many shareholders want. Clearly, the dividend policy is ultimately signed off by shareholders. But I don't think it's rational when you have a stock at 6x to not buy back at least a few shares.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's quite, what's also quite interesting, let's move to another stock in that to similar sort of area, but in more sort of like smokeless stuff, is Supreme, which came out with a very strong trading update this week. But what's sort of quite surprising is that all the big tobacco guys, their main strategy over the next 10, 20 years is to move to things like vaping, to, you know, e-cigarettes, to tobacco for you know, chewing, etc., or what they call nicotine patches, anything not to do with, you know, sort of like traditional cigarettes and cigars. They're all moving to, you know, and vaping seems to be doing really well. Now, what is really surprising is actually, you know, Supreme, which is one of the, you know, one of the biggest vaping brands in the UK. It also does batteries and lighting and sports and nutrition and stuff like that. It trades at roughly, well, about less than 5x EBIT, whereas Bats, because of its debt, trades at 7.5x EBIT. So that, but British American Tobacco, which is trying to move into what Supreme does, is trading at effectively, when you strip out debt, 50% higher valuation. This Supreme, to me, the point is that it looks just ridiculously cheap, and that's simply because of sentiment in the UK towards vaping with the media, etc. But now that the regulatory risk has been taken off because they've put in new legislation to, you know, come in, ban disposables, and also to tighten up the underage vaping, and also they've put a new tax regime coming in, I think, in 2026 for vaping. Once what that's cleared now, the regulatory risk in the UK is cleared. And so you should see over the next 2 to 3 years a re-rating in this, because it just doesn't justify, you know, the sort of like the such low valuations on this business. I don't know what your thoughts are on the company.
Yeah, I've been positive on it when I've covered it before. It could be just small cap premium as well.
You know, discount, you mean?
Yes. The small cap discount could be a big factor there in why it's trading cheaper than Bats. Also, maybe less diversified geographically, and also in terms of products. I know the batteries and the light bulbs and these things are there as well, but I don't think investors seem to really place too much value on them. It's really all about the Elf Bar distribution,
yeah,
and the 88 vape brand.
Yeah,
an 88 vape seems to be in a sweet spot where it's not getting hit too much by the regulation, because I think its flavors aren't affected, but I think Elf Bar possibly is.
Yes,
getting hit by the regulations.
More so, anyway.
Yeah, but of course, but it's in, the distinction is that Supreme doesn't own the Elf Bar brand, but it does distribute it, and that's been a huge growth area for it. So, I mean, look, I do think it's cheap. I think it's too cheap, but 6-7x earnings. And I do think there is clarity on regulations now for at least a few years. I mean, probably, you know, at some point regulations will get reviewed again, but for now, at least, we should be in the clear.
I could tell you, what about, here's a scenario, what about British American Tobacco, which wants to get into vaping or beef it up? I know it has its UK brand, so it isn't probably the archetype, but you imagine a tobacco company wanted to get into UK vaping, then let's go to the preeminent one, the number one, and it would just, you know, get snapped up, wouldn't it? So, yeah. But British American Tobacco isn't the right acquirer, but, it, you know, there will be one who will do it. In fact, it's probably on competition allowance. They couldn't do it, but anyway, wait. Right. Okay, well, let's move on again on the vice theme. Let's go to 888 Group, which is the traditionally been the online gambling business. I knew it from 25 years ago, and it used to be a really well-known name in terms of, you know, sort of like casino games. And bought up William Hill to give it the sports book side of it. So I think it owns William Hill Real Estate as well as the William Hill online brands, which are all, you know, sort of sports betting outside of the US. But it has actually, it's doing all the right things, but did actually build up a pretty big debt pile. And I guess it, you know, BAT can probably just stomach over 3x net debt to EBITDA, but 888 looks a bit stretched on about what 4 or 5x net debt to EBITDA, because their recurring revenue streams are less assured, I imagine. What's sort of your latest on 888, anyways?
Yeah, so I'm a shareholder here, but I bought it when it was cash rich. And in hindsight, I should have exited on the news of the William Hill acquisition. So the latest update we had a week ago from 888 seemed to settle the ship a little bit. Revenues slightly ahead of guidance. This is a big company. It's about 1.7 billion revenues, maybe 1.8 billion revenues. The problem is, well, there's a few problems, but I don't think the retail business is particularly good in terms of just the basic quality of it, the growth. They had a 7% reduction in retail revenue growth. And I just think that, well, if I didn't own shares in 888, I don't think I would buy them today.
So why don't you sell?
But at the same time, I'm too stubborn to sell.
Now that's an interesting. Let's just spend a bit of time on that one. When you say you're too stubborn to sell, is that actually an advantage? Is that sort of like something you should be, you're willing to take pain, even though it is painful? Every time you see this, it's going to be painful for you. But you're willing to basically say, okay, well, it's gone down so much and there still is a chance you could get to something. If this gets taken out by anybody, then it will sort this problem out. Because it's only got a balance sheet issue. It hasn't got any other issues. Or is it, when you say it's too stubborn, is that just being pig-headed and not getting involved and just writing it off and moving on?
Well, when I buy a company that does well, I don't sell it either. So I'm sort of, I will sell in an extreme circumstance, but I don't think 888 is an extreme circumstance where I have to sell it, because it's clearly headed for, the dustbin. It's sort of... it has a chance of making it through, and refusing to sell stocks generally, I think, is a good thing, because it means that I definitely don't suffer what most people have, which is that they chop and change too often. So I definitely don't have that problem. I have other problems, but not that one. 888 is. It's a different beast now. They have a new CEO. So the old management team is basically gone. Funny strategy you mentioned earlier about changing names. They're going to have a new name soon, Evoke PLC.
Okay, good.
So hopefully, I don't know if that will that have wide ranging benefits? I don't know, maybe. And then, they keep insisting that they're going to get the leverage multiple down to 3.5x by the end of 2026. Now, okay, 3.5x is still too high, but if they did it, then the market cap is not going to stay where it is. It's not going to stay at £360 million. So, look, I think they have a chance. They've suffered a lot because quite a lot of their debt is at floating rates, which is a problem. The debt is $1.7 billion net debt thereabouts. They have a serious problem, but they're not at death's door. I think there's definitely a chance they pull through. And so it's something to look at. I must say that if I could go back in time, during the COVID era, when they announced the William Hill acquisition, I just wasn't focused enough on it. And in hindsight, that was a great opportunity to sell. And that would have been justifiable on the basis that it was a change in the business model. It was a significant change in the structure. And so, yeah, absolutely. Selling then, I could have justified it. But given that the share price is already so low, I don't really see the point in selling out now. But it could in time turn out to be worthless if they don't figure it out. But the revenues are definitely there. They've dealt with a lot of their risks. You know, they had a know your customer issue in the Middle East. I think that's been addressed. They previously were very sort of relaxed about operating in untaxed and unregulated markets. They're not relaxed about that anymore. They want to focus on regulated, taxed markets where everything is fully, I don't know if legitimate is the right word, but everything is sort of boxed off from a regulatory point of view. So I think that there's positives here, and they've got a new value creation plan with a whole range of targets, including revenue growth of up to 9% a year that they're looking for, and they want to gradually improve their EBITDA margin. So look, they're making the right noises. I think they're trying, and I think they have a chance. That's the best I can say.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best solution is that somebody comes in here and buys a chunk of their business or all of them, and that'll sort the balance sheet issue out. So you get a good brand, and then you can refinance and take it off expensive debt into a much bigger entity that has fixed interest, long-term debt. And there'll be a lot. I mean, let's be clear about it. Private equity would love it. I'd be stunned if they haven't already had those conversations with private equity. It's just that the price that private equity, they're trying to take them to the cleaners, and therefore it's not acceptable yet by the shareholders or by the founders. But I'm sure that'll be a transaction which will happen if they ever got desperate. But let's wait and see. Okay, well, let's finish this one. Tie a bow on the gambling side. We've got Rank Group, which I know we both like. It owns the Mecca Bingo in the UK and also Grosvenor casinos as well. And I think certainly something that I like about it is that they've got this new legislation coming into the UK in the second half that's going to allow far more slot machines into physical casinos. And I think they can double the number of effectively slot machines inside their properties by the second half of this year. Anyway, can you take us through your latest views? Because we've had some good positive noises from the company.
Yeah, so we had an inline update. Again, this is only about a week ago, something like that. And it was a good update. As I said, it was inline. Like for like, revenues up 6%. Particular strength in the bingo halls, which they said were benefiting from Mother's Day and Easter weekends. Something I perhaps probably didn't give enough attention to before was the Spanish operation. They've got this casino called YoCasino.es in Spain, which seems to be doing very well. Their digital revenues, I'm more interested in the physical venues because that's what's unique about them. What's unique about this company is the Grosvenor Casino and the Mecca Bingo Halls, in my opinion. But having said that, the digital assets do generate 55 million. Well, they did generate 55 million pounds of revenue in Q3. So that's not a bad number in a single quarter. And the stock is trading at 10 times earnings. So, yeah, I do think that this one could be a good recovery candidate. Obviously, COVID was a disaster for them, and they are, because of all the physical venues, energy prices are an issue. They need business travelers and tourists in the UK to frequent the venues, and so there are these macro forces which they can't control, but I think, you know, for such a you know, the Grosvenor brand, I think, is enormous. It's well known. You know, you struggle to find, you know, casinos with better recognition in terms of brand than that one. So for something that has that position, I think it could be worth a look. I mean, I'd be tempted.
No, I would. I mean, I think what you've also got to build in what's going to happen in the next 12 to 18 months. The Grosvenor estate, is going to make a ton of money from doubling its slot machine estate. If you need any sort of, like, you know, reassurance on that, just go to Las Vegas and see how many slot machines are stuffed into these casinos. They haven't got any regulations. They can just put masses in, and it's probably a ratio of about 30 to one actual normal table, sort of like baccarat or roulette or blackjack or something like that. Whereas you've got real tough legislation in the UK which restricts the number of slot machines. They are going to make, Grosvenor Estate is going to make a ton of money. And if they're on sort of 10 to 13 times PE, that's going to halve in 12 to 24 months. And I think this is just going to go boom time. You'll see a massive improvement. I'm not holder of Grank, but if I was, as I say, if I was going to go into gambling, I think this one has got secular growth. And then it'll also have the cyclical one if they get the tourists coming back. So, yeah, I think that's a great, great idea, Graham. Okay, good. Well, we've got a couple of questions coming. I thought a friend of yours, actually, I think Lemon Physical. Have you ever heard of that guy?
Yeah, I know him well, or her.
He says basically, Liebram's research on pay points is compelling. And then we've got Tweed Scott, who I've never heard before, but he's asking about the CVS Group's position with the ongoing CMA review. That CVS is the UK's number one veterinary company, and its shares have been battered because of the uncertainty associated with what the competition authorities are going to do in terms of improving price transparency on vet bills and vet drugs. Don't know if you've had a good look at CVS or a quick skip.
Yeah, no, I've not looked at it recently enough to express a view.
Oh, okay. Well, let me just put the chart up, because I must admit, it's something that is definitely worth a look. What's the Stockopedia PE ratio on it? I bet it's only about 11 times, isn't it? Which has come down a lot.
It's 9.7 on Stockopedia.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's got a really strong balance sheet. I think it plays a bit of a dividend as well. The shares have started, and I know this is a sort of like a Richard Crowe, Cockney Rebel type of bowl activity here. But my instinct, if you've got a 24 sort of 2-year view, you know, prepared to hold and wait on it, then I think this one's come back, because let's be clear about it. It takes 5 years to train a vet. And therefore they've got 10% of the market, or I don't know how much it is, but a big chunk of it. So they're not going anywhere anytime soon. Yes, the CMA review is probably going to stop their M&A strategy, but that doesn't mean they can't, you know, sort of like build out their footprint where geographically they're weak, or just basically put in new technology. So I think this is a good, sound business that has been damaged by the CMA review. But I think all the damage is already in the share price, actually. I don't own it, but it's definitely on my stock watch list.
Cool, very interesting.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, thanks very much, Graham. And just before we finish, what's your sort of the outlook for the rest of the year then, in terms of sort of like, you know, you've had a good, you know, Q1, etc. Certainly with your top 10. And just generally in terms of small caps and what you're looking for?
Well, I suppose interest rates are, will we get these cuts? I mean, you could probably express a more informed view than me, but it seems to me that there's a pretty decent risk we'll be waiting a little bit longer for rate cuts. And that will affect all the cyclical stuff. But in terms of the small caps that I look at, I think there's still incredible value out there. That's why I want more buybacks. You know, a lot of the stocks we've covered today, I think, are objectively good value in a low rate or a high rate environment. So as far as I'm concerned, the macro is not the driver of these ones. It's the, as you said, the idiosyncratic you know, company specific reasons are going to drive these ones. So yeah, I remain very optimistic on many stocks, but obviously it's work every day to figure out the good ones and the bad ones.
Yeah, and I get, unfortunately, I've had my fair percentage of bad ones recently. What percentage of cash do you hold in your portfolio at the moment, just to give us investors?
Oh, I never hold cash.
Oh, okay, you never got. Okay, that's fine. I've got about, I've got about 10 to 15%. So,
10 to 15%,
right. I'm just feeling a bit battered. So, before to try to deploy it. Anyway, thanks again, Graham. And just mentioned to investors, if anybody wants to tune in at 12:30 this afternoon, Graham will be doing his usual tour taking stock. So, I'll be there. So, I might even put some questions if I think of any more to you as well. So,
all right.
Thanks again, Graham.
I hope. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Paul.
Graham. And speak to you in about 2 months' time.
Okay. Cheers. Bye for now.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.